You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now it's Food Friday. This week we're talking about holiday baking. It's the time of year when we might start whipping up big batches of cookies or other favorites for our family gatherings. But with a lot of those gatherings scaled down this year, it's a great time to try something new. And our next guest has ideas on putting a new spin on some of the classics. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your favorite things to bake during the holidays? Are there old family recipes you like to pull out? Are you thinking of trying something new this year? Have you been able to take a simple recipe and give it that little extra something? Or do you need some help? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Sean Bolduc is owner of the Baked Lab in Madison, where he bakes custom cakes and teaches baking workshops. Sean, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, Rob. Thank you so much for having me.
Now, this time of year, Sean puts a lot of people in the baking mood. And I know you have to be in the baking mood all year long, but does this time of year give you a little bit of that extra inspiration?
Oh, man. I mean, there's no better time to bake than the holidays, right? It's like baking is all about sharing and giving. And what better way to show how much you love somebody than through some baked goods?
I understand when you're teaching classes, Sean, you like to inspire people to find things where they can kind of improvise and experiment with new things. And I got to say, when I cook, I'm all about doing that. I can start making a soup and not know what kind of soup it's going to be till halfway through. But mostly when I'm baking, it's like I'm back at high school chemistry class. And I got to do things just the right way. How can I loosen up, man?
Oh, I know. I mean, baking is definitely a science. It's all about the chemistry. But what I like to teach in my workshops is that, you know, when you have a base recipe, like a pound cake or something like that, there's so many different ways that you can flavor it and make it different a million times over, right? So you take that base recipe and then one time you add some orange zest to it. And then the next time you add some cinnamon spice to it and you've got a completely different baked good this time, right?
Yeah, and that reminds me, one of the recipes you passed along to us, we're going to have that up at WPR.org/Food Friday, an orange and apérol loaf. Interesting flavor. It's one thing that you can use that basic template and then jazz it up. So talk about this loaf itself. And first of all, did I say it right?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, I love some apérol, right? A nice aperitivo to have before some dinner. But why not add it to your baked goods? I'm all about adding some booze to my baked goods. But this recipe is just a standard pound cake. And I spiced it up this year with a little bit of orange zest and then a nice little sweet drizzle on top of it that's got some orange and apérol mixed into it. And I'd love to hear what other people are thinking that they can do with this pound cake as well.
Now, talk about the loaf itself. How does this come together? How easy is it for me to make?
Oh, man, this is like one of the most simple recipes, right? You throw a bunch of dry ingredients, your sugar, your flour, your baking powder, all into a bowl together. You add some room temperature butter to it, mix it up, and then you add your wet ingredients and you've got your loaf ready to go. It couldn't be any easier. It's a great beginner recipe. But then it's fun to kind of figure out what you can do from there and change up the flavors next time you make it.
Yeah. So you mentioned the orange zest and the little booze here as the topping we've got online. What other things might you do with that basic loaf to add a completely different twist to it?
Sure. So, you know, flavor profile wise, you could add any type of spice that you wanted to the loaf itself. So you could add cinnamon. You could add a special type of cinnamon. And then, you know, the glaze is just powdered sugar with some type of liquid in it. So you could basically take any type of liquid out of your refrigerator and add it to it, and it'll add its own little flavor profile. So you could do like orange and cranberry, or you could do a bourbon on top of it. Like literally the flavor profiles are endless.
And then you can make this look fancy with that drizzle and how you lay it on there. How do we get the consistency right? Not too thin, not too thick, so we can kind of be artistic with it on top of the loaf.
Totally. I think that making a glaze is like the easiest possible thing that you can do, right? So you've got powdered sugar. You know, I always start for something like this size, about a cup and a half of powdered sugar. And then I'll start with anywhere around like 2 tablespoons of a liquid with it, right? So all of a sudden you're mixing it up and you're like, oh man, this is really thin. So all you need to do to thicken it up a little bit and get it to a consistency that seems right for you is to add a little bit more powdered sugar. And then on the opposite end of the spectrum, if for some reason you've got a glaze that ends up being a little too thick, you just add a little bit more liquid to it.
Talking to Sean Bolduc, baker based in Madison, owner of the Baked Lab. He's giving us some inspiration for trying some new baking projects over this holiday season. Hey, maybe you don't have the big family get together. You don't need 15 dozen sugar cookies to share out among everybody. You want to try something new? Call in at 800-642-1234. Let us know what you're baking. Maybe baking this weekend. Maybe you're in the kitchen right now. If you need some advice from Sean, he may be able to answer your baking questions and concerns. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Now, Sean, you let us know you're a big fan of baking for breakfast. I love baked goods for breakfast or any time, really. You shared with us a recipe for sticky buns, which is hard to go wrong with. Tell us about these guys.
Oh, totally. I know that everybody has been completely obsessed with making sourdough breads this during the quarantine. And most of us probably have a little bit of yeast left over in our refrigerators that we purchased earlier on. Why not make a brioche dough wrapped in cinnamon sugar, topped with like a caramel and pecans for breakfast on Christmas morning, right? So this is basically just a standard brioche dough, an enriched dough. It's got butter in it. It's got some eggs in it, all mixed up. You're going to go ahead and proof that, right? So we're going to let it rise for a couple of hours. And then we're going to turn it into some cinnamon buns and prep it and let it proof overnight in the refrigerator, ready to go on Christmas morning to pop in the oven and have for breakfast.
Okay, but once I know how to make that brioche dough, Sean, where can I take that if I want some variety in my life?
Oh, man. Brioche dough can be used in a million different ways. The first way that comes to mind is a standard just bread, right? So you could make that brioche dough, pop it in a loaf tin, and let that rise, and then you've got a beautiful loaf of brioche dough. You can also use it for something called a babka. Have you heard of a babka before?
I have. I don't know that I could define it for you, though.
Right? So I actually work with another person here in town. We share a kitchen together, and she makes babka on the regular. That's her business. So babka is a brioche dough. It's similarly rolled out like you would a cinnamon bun. It's filled just like you would a cinnamon bun with a bunch of stuff. It's rolled up, but then the cool thing is that it's sliced down the center so you can see all of those beautiful layers of different fillings, and then it's braided and then baked as a loaf. So it's more of a sweet loaf that's got something in it like, say, Nutella or cinnamon pecan, or again, the options are unlimited.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Rosa is with us in Waterford. Rosa, hi.
Hello. I was wondering, do you use the cake flour? Because I've seen that on the store shelves, and you know, wondering what's the main difference. But in most recipes, that usually calls for all-purpose flour, not cake flour.
Oh, when do we use cake versus all-purpose, Sean?
Okay, so the difference between the two is the protein content in there, right? The gluten that is waiting in there for us to activate it with some liquid. So a cake flour tends to be a little bit lighter, has a little less protein in it. For something like a bread, I would not be using a cake flour because it doesn't have enough protein, or it doesn't have enough gluten in it to really develop and get a strong enough dough that can withstand the rise. So for something like a cinnamon bun or a brioche dough, I might go more towards a bread flour, which has more gluten in it, as opposed to maybe a cake or even the pound cake. That might have a little less, and I wouldn't be so apprehensive to use a cake flour. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally. So with the pound cake, though, it sounds like we might be able to do it either way.
Yeah, I mean, you're going to get a different result, right? Mm. I tend to stick with an all-purpose flour for the pound cake, pretty standard. But again, for something like a brioche dough, I definitely would not go with a cake flour for it. If anything, I would either go all-purpose or a little bit heavier with bread flour.
Rosa, thanks a lot for calling in. Hope that helps out. We're talking to Sean Bolduc for this week's edition of Food Friday. He's the owner of The Baked Lab in Madison. We're looking at ways to get creative with our holiday baking, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your favorite thing to bake this time of year, or for somebody else to bake and then you eat? Are there favorite family recipes you're always sure to make if you're not baking for as big a crew as usual this year? Are you going to try something new? And do you need some help with your baking? Maybe a question you have for something you're going to tackle this very weekend. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time.
Support for WPR comes from businesses like Bremer and Trollop Law Offices and Agrace. Business support plays an important role in WPR's success. Details on becoming a business sponsor are at wpr.org/sponsor.
The 2011 political district map changed the game for Wisconsin.
You know, it was pretty much of a Democratic landsliding. You know, we got wiped out. And then somebody said to me, well, don't worry, we're still in control of the assembly. I said, how can that be?
Listen to WPR Reports Mapped Out and find out why maps matter so much. It's at wpr.org/mapped out or wherever you get your podcasts.
Wisconsin Public Radio stays connected with the whole state thanks to its network of 7 bureaus. With reporters on the ground across Wisconsin, WPR provides a news service that connects with issues that matter to your life. Stay in touch with WPR.
You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now we're picking up our Food Friday conversation with Sean Bolduc, owner of The Baked Lab in Madison. We're talking about holiday baking and ways to get creative with some classic recipes. You can join in with your holiday baking favorites or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Lori posted there. She says, we always make snickerdoodles, and we always use colored sugar to decorate. And I love a lot of families, of course, Sean, have their traditions every year. You got to have blank. Are there favorites of yours this time of year?
Totally. So I shared the sticky bun recipe with you guys because I always make cinnamon buns for my family when I'm visiting for the holidays. It is like just a tradition that's kind of come about over the past 10 years. So that's one of my favorite things. The other thing I got to tell you, I'm from Boston originally, and my family is still out there. My dad is one of 17 children. Wow. And I know, right? And my meme used to always make what we call the Swedish pastry. And that reminds me of the holidays as well. It was this mixture of a puff pastry with a shoe dough on top of it, covered in sugar glaze and maraschino cherries. And it just reminds me of the holidays.
And she was baking in bulk, it sounds like.
She was definitely baking in bulk. I don't know how she did it. I don't know how she took care of 17 or feeding 17 kids at the same time. It's wild.
Now, earlier we were talking about flour for cakes. I'm a big fan of when people make, I've never made it myself, a flourless chocolate cake. What goes into making that?
Yeah, flourless chocolate cake really just takes the flour out of it, right? So we've got something like some chocolate mixed with butter, and then we're mixing in some eggs directly into that melted mixture. And then that's pretty much the extent of it. It's going to be a denser cake, right? It's going to be more like a really dense fudgy brownie, but it's also delicious in its own right.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Sherry is with us in Amherst. Sherry, hi.
Hi. Hi, this is Sherry. I'm calling from Amherst. And I just wanted... Hi. Hi. Oh,
Sherry, we lost you there. What baked good did you want to tell us about?
Okay, my sister Dolly. Okay.
You're cutting in and out. I got a note from our producer that your sister makes a cheesecake recipe with a secret ingredient that is cottage cheese. Sorry we lost your line there, Sherry. I've not heard of that. I don't think cottage cheese and cheesecake, Sean?
I have actually never heard of that either. I mean, I guess that it makes sense, right? It's another type of dairy. It's a thickener. Yeah, definitely. I'd be interested in trying that out, although I'm not a huge cottage cheese fan myself.
I understand you do make cheesecake, though. What is your favorite? And you can, this is another one. Once you know how to make cheesecake, I know you can do a lot of different things with it. What's your favorite way to jazz up a cheesecake?
I mean, I got to be honest with you. Cheesecake in its natural form, just like slightly heightened with a really good vanilla, is perfect to me. But I've done everything from adding, okay, this is a little wild. I've added black sesame to cheesecake. So we've got a little bit of like a different peanutty flavor going on in there, and added some raspberry sauce to it. And I think black sesame and raspberry make a fantastic pair. So that's kind of something wild I've done in the past.
Interesting. That sounds pretty good. Sherry, thanks again for calling in and sharing that with us. Let's see. How about cookies, Sean? What's a cookie we can tackle maybe outside of some of the holiday favorites, or a way to jazz up some of the holiday favorites?
Yeah. So I'm always a big fan of, like, again, going back to these basic recipes and then building on them using my own creativity. So I love something like a really good shortbread cookie, and then finding new ways to jazz it up. Maybe this year adding some matcha to it, or adding some fennel to it, and kind of playing with some flavors from there.
Cool. Let's go to Ingrid now in Eagle River. Ingrid, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to comment about your the caller about the flourless chocolate cake. What I do is I put cooked quinoa in a food processor along with cocoa, sugar, and eggs and butter. And mix it all up and pour it in a pan, and it does turn out like a cake. But like the other person mentioned, it is a little denser, but it's not as dense as a brownie. It does taste like a chocolate cake, and it helps for people who have gluten allergies. Huh.
And Ingrid, you said quinoa in your cake.
Quinoa.
Yeah. Okay. Sean, that's interesting. People trying different grains, in this case, I guess, a gluten-free grain in their baking.
Yeah, I'm being stumped today. These are some new ideas. I've never actually heard of quinoa in a flourless chocolate cake, but, you know, it's a starch of sorts and would definitely add a little body to it. And it's probably pretty mild in flavor, so it might add just like a little nuttiness to the chocolate cake. That sounds delicious. I might have to look up a recipe for that one, too.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Sean Bolduc, baker based in Madison, owner of The Baked Lab. He's giving us a lot of inspiration for holiday baking, new twists on some old classics along the way. Hey, here's a challenge for you, Sean. If we can't get together with people and we want to ship them a baked good, what is in your arsenal that would travel the best?
Yeah, you know, you got to go back to those good old cookie recipes, right? Cookies travel the best. One of the things that my grandmother always taught me was when you throw your cookies in a tin to travel, throw a little piece of bread in there, and it'll help keep them nice and moist while they're traveling and won't stale them as quickly. So that's definitely one thing that I would stick to for mailing this winter. People always ask me if they can ship my cakes, and I'm like, I definitely cannot get a cake in the mail to you. I wish I could, though.
Let's go to cottage cheese. Let's go to Mary Beth in New Berlin. This is interesting. Mary Beth, hi.
Hi. I heard that woman that kept getting cut off. My mother made my father a cheesecake with cottage cheese every year for his birthday. And it was just, we all looked forward to it. We only got it once a year. We couldn't wait. And last year was my father, the 100th anniversary of my father's birthday, so I made one. It was so good.
It came out okay. Are you using your mom's recipe, Mary Beth?
I am.
And wow. Does it, I mean, I worry, does it seem like I'm eating cottage cheese in the cheesecake, or is it just kind of all blend in?
No, because you mix it up, and it's got gelatin and egg and heavy cream and maraschino cherries, and you put it into a graham cracker crust. Mm. And I told my sister I was making, she said, I'll be there.
Interesting. Mary Beth, thank you so much for sharing that. And Sean, you know, part of it is the delicious recipe. Part of it, though, is the memories and the occasion, the anniversary of her father's birthday in this case. And I know you do wedding cakes and things like that. How important is it to have that, I guess, that memory and that celebration that goes along with our baking?
Totally. I mean, baking is all about memory, and I agree with that. So oftentimes when I'm making wedding cakes or wedding desserts for a couple, I often start with asking them, is there something nostalgic, like some type of dessert that their family always had for special occasions that they want to incorporate into their special day? And so it's always fun to hear, you know, my grandmother always made lemon pie. And I'm like, okay, well, how can we recreate a lemon pie for this special day and find a new twist to add to it?
And in our last few moments, Sean, do you have advice on making a cake look good? Like, I could bake a cake. It doesn't usually look great. It looks like those, you know, those cake fails that people put on the internet. Do you have a tip to make them kind of social media, Instagram ready, as people say?
Oh, man. So I would say the two things to, if you want to up your cake game, is to get yourself a little turntable to decorate cakes on. They're pretty inexpensive. And also a straight edge. Whenever you're using, putting buttercream or something like that onto a cake, using a straight edge and your turntable, you're going to get a nice clean surface. And that would probably be my best piece of advice for upping your cake game this Christmas.
Fantastic. Sean, it's been a lot of fun. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. You have a great afternoon.
You too. That's Sean Bolduc, baker based in Madison, owner of the Baked Lab. He teaches baking in addition to doing it. And he talked with us about ways to get creative with our holiday baking this year. You can find recipes for those breakfast buns and that great pound cake recipe. We've got it over at WPR.org/Food Friday. And you can share your holiday baking experiments with us on the Ideas Network Facebook page. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. It can feel like the world is a more uncertain place these days, and learning to work through that uncertainty can be hard. But our next guest says there's a secret tool, creativity. She says it's a crucial skill that helps us tackle all kinds of complicated problems in new ways. And we can learn to be more creative with a set of strategies from the world of design. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there something in your life that you think has made you a more creative person, a more creative problem solver? Or do you need help dealing with kind of ambiguous situations where there's not a clear right or wrong answer? Our guest might have some inspiration for you. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Sarah Stein Greenberg is the executive director of Stanford University's Design School. Her new book is called Creative Acts for Curious People, How to Think, Create, and Lead in Unconventional Ways. Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, thanks so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Well, I remember back in school, a lot of problems that you do in your homework had, you knew they had one correct answer. And I found that in real life, a lot of times the problems aren't that simple. How important is it for us to get used to dealing with kind of ambiguity and uncertainty in our lives?
I mean, you really just put your finger on it, right? A lot of educational experiences we have are all based around that idea that there is one right answer. And, you know, the teacher has it on the answer key, and or you can look in the back of the book. And then, you know, you get out of school and all of a sudden things are much more complex. And so one of those things that we try to emphasize when we're teaching design and we're teaching creativity is, you know, we want to have students practice on projects that are going to look a lot more like they do in the real world. And, you know, I think it's really fair to say that in the past 18 months, every single one of us has experienced, you know, really new challenges that have tested us and stretched us. And so having a method, having some confidence around your own creative skills, figuring out how can I apply them in this time of great uncertainty, I think some of those strategies can be really useful.
I know, I think creativity sometimes is a thing that you either got it or you don't, or you have a fixed amount of creativity. You work to help educate people on being more creative. Is it possible to boost our, creativity quotient?
Absolutely. You know, I think it's really one of those unfortunate myths in our society that only some people are creative. And it's interesting because a lot of people immediately when they meet me, they say, well, I'm not very creative because I can't draw. And there's this real tight association that people have with being good at a certain type of, visual output and creativity. Well, I honestly think that could not be further from the truth. So you can be extremely creative as an educator. You can be extremely creative as a nurse. You can be extremely creative as somebody who works in government. And so part of our mission at the D School is really to help expose more people to these basic strategies. We actually really, in this moment in history, we need more people exercising their creative abilities to solve the kinds of problems that we're all up against.
And you give a really good example to open your book. Actually, it's in comic strip form, creatively, that shows that creativity isn't just about, you know, making cool music or visual art. You look at some students who are trying to help a hospital in India. Could you just talk a little bit about how their creative thinking helped overcome this medical challenge?
Yeah, so they were, we had a team of students. They came from all different parts of Stanford, a couple med students, a policy student, and an engineer. And so they came together around this challenge of really trying to help this hospital in southern India figure out how to act on their mission, which was around delivering very high quality but low cost care at a large scale. And the students went in thinking, you know, okay, well, given that mandate, we're really going to help them reduce some of the costs, or we're going to help the clinicians be more efficient with their time. But when they actually started getting to know the folks in the hospital and they went and did some interviews and observations, what they realized is there was a whole other opportunity that was kind of hiding in plain sight. And they noticed in particular that there were a lot of family members of the patients who were waiting around. They didn't have access to good information about what was happening, and they were really stressed out and anxious about what was going to happen when their family member returned home. So the students decided, okay, this is actually a really important need. Nobody else is addressing it yet. So let's see if we can try to alleviate this suffering of these family members. And what they wound up designing was an educational opportunity for people who, while they're spending time and waiting in the hospital, they're getting training on how do you take a pulse? How do you practice the important hygiene regimen for when your family member has just had surgery and they return home? And through that intervention, they've actually created an organization called Neura Health, which has trained over 1 million family members across South Asia to be really active participants in caring for their loved ones. And that has reduced hospital readmissions and reduced post-surgical complications. And the amazing thing is that it's really not the framing of the problem that the students approach, it's not what they went in with. And so part of design work and part of creative work is that you remain open to possibility. And that is part of what allows you to really solve problems in unconventional ways. And that is exactly the kind of thinking that I think we need more of and that we strive to teach at the D School.
Talking to Sarah Stein-Greenberg from Stanford University's Design School. Her new book is called Creative Acts for Curious People, How to Think, Create, and Lead in Unconventional Ways. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has creative thinking helped you in your personal life or on the job? Are there things that helped you think, become a more creative problem solver? Do you have ways of teaching other people to solve problems creatively? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Sarah, let's dive into the heart of your book now, which is exercises. Some people can do alone, some in pairs, some in big groups, maybe even a whole class. What was your goal in creating these exercises or adapting, in many cases, things from your students and colleagues?
Yeah, so all of the exercises that are in the book are really pulled directly from our large teaching community. And these are real assignments that we teach at Stanford, but they're very flexible. So as you said, you can do them in lots of different contexts. And what I'm hoping to do is to get everybody to just try something that's a little bit out of their comfort zone. So in some cases, you know, folks have that block around like, oh, I'm not sure how to express myself visually. I've got all these ideas, but I just don't know how to draw. I don't know how to build my ideas into a format where other people can give me feedback about them. So there are assignments that are about visualization. There are assignments that are about what we call prototyping, which is kind of building rough models very early in your process. So somebody could actually say, oh, I get what you're saying. I get what your idea is. Let me give you some feedback. On the other hand, there are folks who, you know, the skill that they're looking to develop is about how do I receive feedback differently? Or how do I reflect on and notice my own creative abilities and how they're changing over time and how I'm learning? And so there's a whole section of assignments that are really around reflection and self-awareness and understanding and kind of assessing your own creativity and your own creative abilities. And I really believe, you know, it's like no one person has exactly the same set of needs as a learner, as a creative person. No creative project looks exactly the same. So in this book, I really want readers to be able to navigate for themselves and figure out what are the particular skills you're most interested in acquiring today. And there's something in there, I think, for everybody.
Let's check out a couple that maybe people could try at home. One that I liked, and this is one you can do solo, I believe, a seeing exercise. Talk us through this one, please.
Yeah, this is a great exercise that was adapted by a group that really specializes in what are called visual thinking strategies. And it's amazing what we don't realize we're not noticing all around us on a daily basis. And so this exercise has you take a photograph. You can take, there's one in the book you can use for practice, or you can take one from a newspaper, and really just kind of slow down your thought process. So you look at the photograph and you ask, what am I seeing here? And then you ask, what makes me say that? What is actually the data or the thing that I'm observing that makes me interpret the thing that is happening here in this picture? And then you ask yourself that again and again. And you spend maybe about 15 minutes with one photo. And you start to notice detail that you just realize, wow, in those first 5 minutes, you didn't even notice that whole section. Or you didn't notice that dynamic or the shadows or some kind of relationship. And what you begin to realize is that because our brains are constantly filtering the information that we're seeing all around us, there are opportunities that are lying in plain sight. And just like those students in India, when they had the opportunity to really observe the situation and notice in a bit of a different way, they spotted an opportunity that was being unaddressed. And that's often where a lot of opportunity for creative problem solving or for innovation comes from, is noticing that thing that no one else has actually identified as a problem or an opportunity.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Dave is with us in Winter. Dave, hi.
Hello, good afternoon. I have continued my education by listening to Wisconsin Public Radio. I've been listening now for about 25 years, and I'm serious. It opens my eyes to a lot of different things, and it makes me think about getting a second opinion about some things. Some things that I recognize being talked about, I'll play back on your tapes. I just want to thank you for that great community service that you're providing, and keep on keeping on.
Dave, thank you so much for sharing that. And I hope Wisconsin Public Radio does this well, but that reminds me of one of your exercises, expert assumptions. Dave was talking about going back and examining things and getting other opinions. One of your assignments, this one takes a little longer, involves doing something kind of like that.
Yeah, that's right. There's a wonderful practice. You know, most people have heard of brainstorming, right? Mm-hmm. But there's another important practice, which is called assumption storming. And that is really useful when you want to make sure that you're kind of like challenging yourself to find that second opinion, as Dave was saying, or you're thinking about a problem or an opportunity through multiple lenses. And assumption storming simply has you break down the problem or the thing that you're working on and list all of the assumptions that you can think about. So in the book, I use the example of, you know, let's say you work in your public library and you're trying to redesign what the entryway might be. What should the experience be for people who are coming in? What should it feel like? What should it look like? What activities might happen there? And to begin, you just might list all the assumptions that you have about how a library, quote, has to function, right? It has to be quiet. It should be accessible to everyone. it tends to attract such and such a kind of person in the community. It does or doesn't have computer access. And once you list all of those assumptions, you might find that some of them are facts, some of them are more opinions, and some of them are kind of guesses. And you can just, in that structured way, recognize, wow, if I challenge some of those things that are opinions or guesses, well, I'm going to have a whole lot more creative space to play in. But if you don't name those as assumptions, you might sort of unconsciously assume that that whole part of the situation is fixed, right? That there's no changes or improvements possible. And so surfacing those early in a process is actually really valuable for creating more open space within your design work.
Thanks again for that call, Dave. We're talking to Sarah Stein-Greenberg, head of Stanford University's Design School. Her new book is called Creative Acts for Curious People, How to Think, Create, and Lead in Unconventional Ways, jam-packed with exercises you can use, you and groups of others as well, if you want, to help boost your creative problem solving. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is there something in your life that's inspired creativity, whether for fun, or for serious purposes? Do you find creative solutions to difficult problems? Do they come easily for you, or is it hard work? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation about how to do a better job dealing with uncertainty using creative strategies from the world of design. Sarah Stein-Greenberg is with us. Her new book is Creative Acts for Curious People, How to Think, Create, and Lead in Unconventional Ways. Still time for your call with your questions about how to be more creative, or maybe your experiences, something that's inspired you, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Okay, Sarah, you've got a couple exercises that would work well with pairs of people. I usually hate icebreakers at meetings because I'm surly and standoffish, but these I would do. I want to check out a couple of them. One called First Date. I read this one, I laugh about it. First Date, Worst Date.
Yeah, this is one of my favorites. And, you know, it's interesting that you say you hate icebreakers. I'm also not a big fan of icebreakers. We use a lot of what we consider kind of warm-up activities, which, yeah, you know, there's a similarity with ice breaking, but I always try to use one that is related to the behavior, the kind of creative action that I want someone to take later on in the session. So I'll tell you what I mean by that. So First Date, Worst Date is a really fun kind of combination of storytelling and building with physical materials. So you sit with a partner and each of you build a representation using Legos of your first worst date. And it's kind of amazing because like everybody has a story about this. Maybe it's a romantic date. Maybe it's like a professional date or some other kind of date, but everybody has a funny or a embarrassing or a touching kind of story about this. And the thing that's the challenge is that's kind of an abstract prompt. Like, are you going to express a feeling through Legos? Are you going to kind of tell a linear narrative about something that happened? And I've seen people kind of create like a cliff, you know, out of Legos, because that was what the date felt like falling off a cliff, right? Or you know, sort of something that like started poorly but ended well, and you can kind of see how they've created that in a physical form. And it's a really interesting skill to develop, because as I was saying earlier, when you learn how to express your kind of abstract, fuzzy, new ideas about the kind of solution you might be thinking about, and you put those into a physical object, all of a sudden someone else can say, oh, I understand what you're saying. Like, let me respond to that. Let me give you some feedback. Oh, let me build on that. Let me give you some new ideas. So that process of taking something out of your brain and putting it into the real physical world, even if that's not the way it's going to live on as a product or a service, that is one of those core skills in design that I think everybody can use a little bit of.
Let's go back to our callers now. William is with us in Wakefield, Michigan. William, hi.
Oh, hello. I just want to say thank you so much for what you do, and wish everybody out there a positive day. I just found out through this pandemic or epidemic, whatever you might want to categorize it as, that people become more lenient on the internet. And I just want to give, I guess, a shout out to the YouTube that's been remarkable, because you can tailor, you know, your highlights for what excites you, and basically see true, you know, live stories about people's, you know, ups and downs and how they overcome things and kind of get yourself before you even know it.
You're breaking up, William, but point taken. William has found a lot of creativity on the internet and sounds like he's inspired, especially by young people using the internet creatively to express themselves. What do you think, Sarah?
Yeah, I mean, I think what I'm hearing in that example is, you know, kind of some empathy that you can develop, right? You see someone's story, you really identify with it, or maybe they are living a different life from you, but you kind of get that sense of the ups and downs. And, you know, empathy is something we talk a lot about in design work because you're really usually designing something for other people, right? That's part of what, you know, separates design from art in a way. And so if you're trying to come up with a creative solution that meets the needs of someone else, you got to understand them. You got to understand what motivates them and what they need and how their life might be better if you can design a solution for them. And so I love that example of this sort of unconventional source of input and inspiration to really understand and identify with the experiences that other people are having.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Sarah Stein-Greenberg about her new book, Creative Act for Curious People. Back to your calls now with Dan by Rice Lake. Dan, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I was thinking about this and joining the show. I taught visual media in universities for 38 years, and the key for most of the students to make a change in how they were thinking about, for example, their photographs, was to get them to define the photograph by way of adjectives rather than nouns. It was that simple. And all of a sudden they start seeing much more in the photograph if it is something other than a dog or any other descriptor of that sort. So just changing the basic language you use to describe what you're doing from nouns to adjectives.
Dan, thanks for that call. And I think, Sarah, correct me if I'm wrong, you've got an exercise in your book that looks at a picture and ask you to describe what the person in the picture is doing, first by nouns, then by verbs. So very similar exercise to what Dan did.
Yeah, I'm so struck by the similarities. And, you know, first of all, what an amazing lesson from, you know, clearly a master educator that we just heard. I think that, you know, part of what's going on there is just the power of framing, right? And in that case, like shifting from nouns to adjectives creates this whole new way of seeing, right? That's really interesting. And the exercise that you're describing, Rob, we often assume or interpret so much of what's going on and what people might need. So in this particular one, you look at a picture and you try to come up with like, what do you think the person in the picture actually needs? And almost every time, all of the first things that people come up with are nouns. And that is kind of like the solution already. But if you can change your language to verbs, so in the case of this picture, there's a young girl who's standing on a ladder and reaching up in a bookcase. So the first thing people usually say is like, oh, she needs a book, or she needs learning, or she needs knowledge, or she needs a parent to come help her. But actually, if you say, oh, she needs to reach, she needs to learn, she needs some help, right? There, that actually creates, well, there are lots of different ways that she could learn. There's lots of different ways that she could get help. And whereas if you just say like, oh, she needs a ladder, she needs a chair, she needs a longer arm, that's kind of limiting the solution space. So shifting that vocabulary towards something that's much more open-ended, that's one of those techniques that you can use to create much more opportunity for yourself when you're setting out in a creative project.
Dan, thanks a lot for that call. Just in our last few moments, Sarah, can you leave us with a bit of inspiration to try some creativity tonight?
You know, I think it is all about trying. And one of our key philosophies is like, especially as an adult, it's all about learning by doing. So if you happen to grab this book, or maybe you're trying to learn something new and you're using YouTube, right? Like actually just learn how to change the mirror, the side mirror on my car. Like just stretch yourself to just try to learn something new. That actually like fills us up so much. And you can do that in very, very small ways. But the key is not just to think about something, but actually to try it out. That changes your disposition towards the thing that you're trying. It builds your confidence. And whether that's a creative act or some other thing that you're learning, that would be my provocation, my last word on this.
Sarah, thank you so much for being with us today. It's been a lot of fun.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
That's Sarah Stein-Greenberg, Executive Director of Stanford University's Design School. She was with us today to talk about her new book. It's called Creative Act for Curious People, How to Think, Create, and Lead in Unconventional Ways.